Hello, it's Thursday, October the 28th. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, a consequence of the pandemic. More and more of us are building a bar indoors. We'll be talking about the city. We're also talking about trigger warnings on children's books, including classics like Little House on the Prairie. It's the Woke Brigade. You know it is. Also, if you've got an older car, a diesel car, you're going to have to start paying more for it. It's already happening in London. It's going to be happening in about 30 other towns and cities. But first, the budget. The first poll shows more than half of us approve and only 15% disapprove. No wonder Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, is smiling so much. So the Chancellor's delivered his budget for what he says is post-COVID Britain. A first snap poll has found that over half of us approve of the measures announced by Rishi Sunak, despite a report from the Institute for Fiscal Studies which suggests people will be worse off next year due to rising inflation and increased taxes. Chris Hopkins is Associate Director of Savanta Comres, which carried out the survey, and he joins us now. Chris, it's often in the days after the budget that shockers emerge from the detail of the Red Book and budgets may start to unravel. But I have to say, this is a very, very positive start for Rishi Sunak. 53% approve, only 15% disapprove.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, Andrew, the devil is usually in the detail, and I'm sure there'll be tougher days to come for the Chancellor and some of his policies. But at the end of the day, they trailed a lot of the bad news beforehand, especially over the last few weeks, particularly with national insurance rises. And at the end of the day, the budget that we heard yesterday in the House of Commons ended up being quite a giveaway budget. It ended up having a lot of good news in it. And therefore, I'm not really surprised that when we put that to the public, people did end up approving.
Yeah, there was more money for affordable housing, money for cladding, for people who need to get rid of this terrible cladding off their blocks of flats. And of course, the big giveaway was the reform to universal credit, which means those people who are working, if they get a better paid job, they will lose less of their benefits. So that was all cleverly packaged by the Chancellor. I think Chris is proving to be probably one of the most political chancellors we've ever had in Number 11. Certainly, I've not seen anyone like that since Gordon Brown.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this did, this did feel a little bit like a potential Gordon Brown budget. And I think, from Rishi Sunak's point of view, this was his first real opportunity to be able to deliver some good news. Yes, okay, he's given away a lot of things, and he's had to through the pandemic. But a lot of his addresses to the House of Commons, the really important ones that will stick in people's minds, have been, with a backdrop of a lot of negativity, a backdrop of a pandemic, a backdrop of having to make really difficult decisions and having to do things that aren't, strictly that conservative. I think in many respects, we kind of got back on course and was able to do something that he probably really wanted to do. And yes, okay, obviously the pandemic isn't out of the way, and the UK will be recovering economically for a long time. But I think this was a first real opportunity, similar to his conference speech, which was the first real opportunity to lay out his plans to Conservative members. This was the first real opportunity to deliver a budget that I think he would want to. And I think the public, will approve of him, and ultimately, they're three times more likely to trust Rishi Sunak with the economy than they are the Prime Minister. So I think, as far as he's concerned, it's job done.
Yeah, and I'm also looking in there too, Chris, in the detail of your poll. Labour still regarded as the party of increased public spending, even though this government is spending more now than at any time any other government since the spendthrift days of the 1970s.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be really difficult for Labour to shake that label. Similarly, the Conservatives are more likely than Labour to be considered the party of economic responsibility. But one interesting finding that we did see there is that the Tories are just narrowly considered to be the party of higher taxes. And I think that is something that is interesting. Voters don't usually reward parties that are seen to be raising taxes at the ballot box. But frankly, while Labour are doing very little actual opposition, I think the government are going to continue to get away with things.
Very, very interesting. That's Chris Hopkins, who's Associate Director of Savanta Comres, whose poll says 53% of us approve of the budget and only 15% disapprove. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to stereo Alexa the speaker to play Daily Mail News. This week, the ultra-low emission zone charge, known as ULEZ, was expanded, meaning around 300,000 motorists living in or commuting into London now face a daily charge of £12.50 on top of other taxes such as the congestion charge. Soon drivers of older cars in some 15 other cities will likely face similar emissions tax zones as the government orders councils to clean up their air. Edmund King is president of the AA and warns it could price many lower income drivers off the roads, and he joins me now. So Edmund, that's a pretty hefty increase, isn't it? £12.50 for which drivers have to fine, and that's probably going to apply in quite a lot of our other cities too.
Yeah, I think it's a real problem for those people on low incomes, and particularly those that bought diesel vehicles in good faith when they were encouraged by various governments to do so. And now they're either having to scrap those vehicles or put up with a £12.50 a day charge. But it is a difficult situation because you've got to balance the cost that is inflicted on people plus with the kind of environmental problems. And we all know in London toxic pollution has been an issue, particularly with those suffering from heart or lung disease or things like asthma. So it is all about getting that balance and cleaning up the air. And there certainly is some evidence from central London that the initial ultra-low emission zone has actually reduced nitrogen dioxide by about 40%. So it has had an effect, a positive effect in the centre of London. But it's about getting that balance and making sure that people aren't priced out of work.
And of course, people in London already have to pay the £15 congestion charge, which now, of course, is 7 days a week, apart from Christmas Day. And I'm not even sure you're not charged on Christmas Day. It's a daily charge. So that's making it prohibitively expensive, particularly if they then have to pay to park their car. The other thing is, do you think motorists who are liable for this charge, motorists who are driving a diesel car or an older petrol car, know that they have to pay this extra money?
Well, there were certain surveys before the ultra-low emission zone was expanded to the North Circular and the South Circular, so, you know, an 18-fold expansion. And there were various surveys that showing that only about a third of people were fully aware of it, you know, despite the fact that there have been signs up, there have been some campaigns, it has been talked about since 2019. But all of these things are quite complicated. I mean, you can go to some parts of London now and there's signs about the congestion zone, there's signs about the clean air zone, there's parking restriction signs, there's residence parking signs. It is getting more and more difficult, frankly, to drive a car in London. Unless, I'd say, you've got a pure electric car at the moment, which is exempt from congestion charge and is exempt, obviously, from this emission zone, and in some areas is exempt from parkings. But obviously, not everyone can afford an electric car. And it is those people who work shift work who can't perhaps use public transport in the middle of the night or early in the morning to get to hospitals, to work as porters, to work as nurses, etc. And it is those people that are getting hit. There was some help offered in a car scrappage scheme in London where you could get up to £2,000 for your older diesel or older petrol car. But it is actually quite limited to a limited number of people, and apparently there's only enough grant left to support another 1,500 cases. So even with that scrappage scheme, a lot of people fall outside of the criteria to qualify for that.
It's outrageous in some respects, isn't it? A commendable and laudable as it is to try to get to grips with pollution. Many people who will be hit because they're driving older diesel cars bought those diesel cars because they were flipping well encouraged to do so by the government, which said they were environmentally friendly.
Yeah, it is particularly those families that bought people carriers some time ago, and they were told at the time that diesel was cleaner than petrol based just on CO2, because diesel vehicles tend to get more miles to the gallon, so it tends to put out less CO2. But what they weren't told at the time is that it actually puts out more nitrogen dioxide and overall, particularly in urban areas, can be a problem. So in effect, people were missold the information on vehicles, and now that's coming up to catch us. But, you know, obviously we know that things do have to change. The government has said by 2030 all new petrol and diesel cars and vans will be outlawed. Obviously you can still buy second-hand petrol and diesel cars, and the newer petrol and diesel cars are much cleaner and greener than those of 10 or 15 years ago. But it's just those people on the fringe that just can't afford to change their car, that live just within the North Circular. But and even if they have to travel to work outside of the North Circular, they will still be hit on a daily basis because, you know, they cross the line of the ultra-low emission zone. And it's those people that I have a great deal of sympathy for.
Who'd have a car, honestly?
Well, I've got to say, within London now, you know, I live just outside London. And even though I've got a car that's exempt, I happen to have an electric car, even I just don't drive into London now. To be honest, it is so complicated now with all these restrictions,
exactly.
With
Baffling.
Bus lanes, with taxi lanes, with, you know, different zones. But, you know, London's got to be careful because if it gets far too restrictive, many people will vote with their wheels and move out of London. And I do know from an employment point of view, there are quite a few job vacancies in London because many people just can't afford to live in London anymore. So it does have a broader effect, broader than just the transport issues, to the whole economy of London that can suffer as a result of some of these moves.
Absolutely. That's Edmund King, who is president of the AA. Note, he's got an electric car. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So classic children's books, including Little House on the Prairie and The Wizard of Oz, are going to be labelled with trigger warnings in a Cambridge University archive. The project, which is funded by the Arts Council, will identify books which they say contains harmful content relating to slavery, colonialism and racism. Chris McGovern is chairman of the Campaign for Real Education and joins me now. Chris, my heart sank when I read this. Did yours?
It absolutely did. And it's nothing new, actually. I recall not so long ago there was an attempt to ban Snow White from schools because the prince kisses the Snow White character when she's asleep without permission. So we live in a sort of woke-infected educational environment. I mean, many of the people who ban these books are actually quite well-intentioned, but they're what they're doing is that they're putting their own angst and anxieties and concerns onto the shoulders of children. You know, children, particularly young children, they believe in goblins and fairies and Father Christmas. They have no time for these silly adults with their woke ideas. And when you say we're going to close off great works of children's literature, then you're closing off another world which these children need to enter. These children need to be aware that perhaps in the past people saw things differently. And you know, fairy tales, which hundreds, perhaps thousands of years old in some cases, they're full of scary stories. They prepare children for the real world. So, you know, Hansel and Gretel, whose stepmother wanted to starve them, sent them into the forest, and they get taken by this witch, and she's going to put them in a pot and boil them up and eat them. Well, that's a pretty scary story, but it prepares children for another world. So, yeah, speaking on behalf of children, I've taught children for 35 years, including very young children. They will be as appalled as I am by this total nonsense from Homerton College, Cambridge.
Yeah, I'm just looking. The Little House on the Prairie is being criticised for the stereotypical depictions of Native Americans.
Well, yes. I mean, of course, people in the past had a different view, and there's no harm, particularly with older children, in explaining to them that, you know, people saw things differently in those days. What I noticed that Cambridge University aren't banning the autobiography of Mary Seacole. Mary Seacole, an admirable figure, she was voted the number one black Briton. But if you read her autobiography, she says a lot of racism, which she describes as degenerate Arabs, worse than fleas. If I was a Turkish child, I might be upset by that. But you know, no one's calling for Mary Seacole's books to be banned because they obviously are important. We should, and older children and students at university should study them. So this interference is very selective, and it's really quite worrying, I think, for the future of our education system and indeed for the future of our children's mental health.
It's interesting also that caught up in this is Harper Lee's classic To Kill a Mockingbird, which I always thought was a classic tale of white man coming to the aid of the wrongly accused black man, and a public hero he was for it.
He was, and indeed there was a very famous film Gregory Peck made. It's a long time ago since
Atticus
I read that book.
Finch.
It's a very powerful book and a very powerful film to go with it. And indeed, it shows you that there was racism and the horrible side of racism. And it was actually a set text, really, for GCE O-level in the old days, and then more recently for GCSE. Now, of course, it's frowned on because it depicts racism, and you can't really discuss that in school these days without sort of making apologies and everything else, you know. You know, the Bible would be banned if these people had their way, because the Bible is full of all sorts of nasty things. I mean, I doubt there's any book, actually, which wouldn't be banned. You know, even some of the works of David Walliams, which are very popular. One of the books about a penguin who wants to fly, I think it's called Geronimo. Well, Geronimo is a Native American, so you can't use that name. But, you know, this is the crazy world in which we're now living.
Is it appropriate for public money in the form of an Arts Council grant of £81,000 to be used to fund this sort of work?
No, it isn't appropriate. And I think any taxpayer would be concerned that money is being used to support it's a teacher training college, Homerton at Cambridge, which has got this archive together, that people will be concerned that money is being used to actually destroy the identity of fairy tales and of children's fiction. You're now saying you've got to sanitize it, it's got to go through censors, and they're not taking into account why these books have survived for so long and why they are so popular. Children love these books, and you know, the problem we really have is too many youngsters leaving school and they are illiterate. And I work with these days, now I'm retired, I work with underprivileged children. And what I found is that one of the reasons why underprivileged children often can't read is because their parents can't read, and their parents have been through our education system. They don't come on the radio, they don't come and talk to anybody else because they're ashamed. But, you know, we've got a problem in this country of literacy. It's quite a serious one. And therefore, if there's £80,000 to be spent on literacy or on books, it should be improving the standards of literacy in the country, improving the material available for children. I mean, from the point of view of the Campaign for Real Education, we want children to read. We're not too worried about what they're reading, and we want them to read as much as possible, and we want to get over this problem of illiteracy. We also work with young offenders in prisons, and what we find in prisons is that they are full of young people who are illiterate and also innumerate, as it happens. That those children, those young people, you know, they never got taught, and therefore they become marginalized in society. We're not going to take away any blight or the fairy tales or the Little House on the Prairie to meet the needs of some woke, infected educationist at Cambridge. No, put the children's interests first, and the children's interest is to read. They love these stories. Leave the kids. I remember when I was teaching in my earlier days, there was a very famous Pink Floyd song, and it was Leave Those Kids Alone, you know. Teacher, leave those kids alone. These teachers now, or these educators of teachers, these teacher trainers, are actually a danger. They need to carry the trigger warning, not the fairy tales and not the stories. They need to carry the trigger warning.
Listen, I agree with everything you say, but just on behalf of the Arts Council, they may say, if they were here, Chris, we need to do this because some children may read these books, particularly if they're a child of colour, and be mortally offended. Therefore, they should know before they open the pages what they might encounter.
Yeah, but actually, this particular list is as much a trainee teachers. But yes, I understand the good intentions, but I think we need to also understand that children are far more robust than sometimes adults give them credit for. We talk a lot about snowflake kids, but actually they're not all snowflakes. I think if you talk to most people, including members of minority communities, I mean, for example, let me take the Jungle Book. Rudyard Kipling was a famous writer. He wrote the Jungle Books, perhaps one of the most famous children's books of all. But, you know, it's written by a colonialist who had racist views. Are we going to say to children, black, white, or whatever colour, you can't learn about Mowgli in the Jungle Book because it may have racial undertones? No, it's total nonsense. They need to wake up, and actually they need to talk to the children. Do you want to ban these books, children? Do you want to ban the Jungle Book, for example, and new fairy tales? They will tell these educators where to get off.
Very interesting as ever. Chris McGovern, who tells it as it is, he's the chairman of the Campaign for Real Education.
very important now to test the temperature in the city after Chancellor Rishi Sunak's speech. We know one poll has already shown more than half the public liked the budget. But what are they saying in the city? Who better to tell us than Ruth Sundon, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. Ruth.
Well, Andrew, before we get to all of that, I've got to congratulate you. I know you're far too modest to say anything about this yourself, but I'm sure your listeners will agree that you're very well deserving of the award that you've won for, I think it's Multimedia Journalist of the Year, is it, in the London Press Club Awards, one of the most coveted prizes?
You're quite right, Ruth. That's very sweet of you. It's, well, this podcast is a key part of it, actually. And as you know, I write a lot for the paper and I do radio and TV. So I was very pleased to get the award. Particularly, Ruth, as I beat Jeremy Clarkson, who was on the shortlist.
Oh, well, that is fantastic news. That must make it taste even sweeter, Andrew. And listen, I'm very honoured that you have plebs like me on. You know, that's fantastic.
Well, it's because we have great people like you on the podcast, Ruth, that it was deemed to be worthy of getting an award. So, less about me. What about Rishi? What's the view 24 hours later, Ruth, when the dust has settled?
Well, I think the dust is beginning to settle a little bit, and I think people, you know, the Chancellor described this budget as one for a new age of optimism post-COVID and post-Brexit, but I'm not sure that people in general are going to be feeling the love when all of this sinks in and when they look forward to the coming year. Really, what is likely to happen to a lot of people is that a combination of tax increases, which are quite hefty, and of high inflation are going to hit their living standards. A middle-income earner is much likely to be worse off next year than better because wage rises are not that strong. We did see a bit of a bounce back, but it was from the low base that had come into effect because of COVID. So, I mean, there is some good news, as we were discussing yesterday, in the sense that the economy has bounced back quite strongly. The forecasts from the Office of Budget Responsibility were better than they were, much more optimistic than expected in March. But it's what Rishi's done about that, really, that I think is causing a little bit of unease. So in March, it looked as if we were in a real mess. You know, that's not news to anybody. So Rishi, at that point, announced some quite big tax rises. Now, it turned out to be not as bad as the OBR thought. He could have reversed and unwound some of those tax rises, but he's chosen not to. Instead, he's banked that money. He's increased spending and he's trying to curb borrowing, but he hasn't rowed back on his tax increases. Now, I guess we can hope, well, maybe he's gearing up for a pre-election giveaway.
I'm sure he is.
You know, which I'm sure he is. But he could have reversed, this is the IFS have calculated this, he could have reversed out a third of the increases coming down the pipeline if he hadn't increased his spending plans. Now, my suspicion is maybe he wants to keep some of those red wall voters that they've won and that be quite near his constituency in Richmond in North Yorkshire. Maybe he wants to keep them sweet with higher public spending and the valuable services that we all use. But it's a very delicate balancing act he's doing here. And I think the higher taxes combined with inflation, combined with bigger energy bills, you know, all of these things are I don't think there's going to be a lot of a feel-good factor. So he's been very effortlessly popular, has Rishi, until now. And I think it's going to be a bit of a sterner test for him in the coming months.
Indeed it is. That's Ruth Sunderland, who's ever's got her finger on the pulse in what's happening in the Square Mile. Thanks for joining us. So maybe it's a result of the lockdown, or maybe it's because us Brits just love a tipple. But it appears more than 15 million homes across the UK now have home bars. Complete with shining optics, cocktail ingredients and even pub signs, home bars are now so popular they're thought to add value to your home. Siobhan Murphy was the runner-up of 2021's Interior Design Masters with Alan Carr, and she's got some top tips for creating your own home bar. Siobhan, hello to you. Now, was the lockdown a factor, do you think, in the huge numbers of people who are now putting in a bar?
Yeah, I really think it was. So Clink have done that research that shows like now 15 million people in the UK have got a bar, but actually 2.7 million of those put their own bar up during lockdown, and I've got to say I was one of them.
Right. Was that because you used to like to go to the pub for a drink? You couldn't, so you thought, have a drink at home, yeah, sitting at the bar?
Yeah, absolutely. It was like, right, well, I can't go to the local, can't get my glad rags on a Saturday night,
no,
and head to the cocktail bar in town, so I'm just going to create my own at home. So, yeah, so that's what I did.
So how did you do it?
So we were lucky because we had a room, and it was a room that just wasn't being used, and it was kind of like, we're going to turn it into an office, or we're going to turn it into a reading room. And obviously then lockdown hit, and I was like, right, okay, I know what this room's going to be. It's going to be a cocktail bar. And basically I just painted it pink. I got a cocktail bar from Facebook Marketplace, a secondhand like 1970s vintage one, which I customised, and just added loads of lights, loads of neon, loads of nice seating, cushions to make it really sumptuous. And it's a bit of Miami, really, I would say.
Yeah.
Art Deco my house.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of Art Deco in West Yorkshire.
And how often do you and your other half sit at the bar and have a drink? And who pours the drinks? You or your other half?
I'm definitely the chief cocktail maker,
right,
in the house.
Yeah.
Nick will have a few cocktails, but he's mainly a beer drinker, so that's quite easy. But yeah, I'm definitely the cocktail maker. I like to, you know, really like, you know, experiment with cocktails. I've got all like the cocktail books and everything. And yeah, I like to make them look pretty, you know, all the like the garnishes and things like that. Whereas Nick's quite happy just having like, you know, a glass of real ale or, you know, something,
yeah,
like that. But it's just really nice, you know, like to have friends over and have, you know, family over. And, you know, even if we've got friends over for dinner or, you know, we always end up in the bar, which is really, you know, which is really nice. And, you know, I just said to my husband the other day, it's actually nice when we got there, even if we just spend an hour there, because we switch our phones off or we leave them downstairs and we can actually talk to each other, you know, just so it's actually, it gives us an excuse,
yeah,
to reconnect really in that
Sounds
way,
great.
which is nice, yeah.
And the bar's upstairs, is it?
Yeah, so we've got, so it's up on the top floor. It's like a circular room. We call,
yeah,
it the Tower Cocktail Bar.
Right.
And so, yeah, so it's a bit of a trek, but, you know, we get up there eventually. And,
well, that's good for you. A bit,
know,
of exercise.
Stumble down.
Yeah, yeah.
Do, lethal cocktails.
And how much do you think it costs you to buy the bar, to adapt it, to put in the neon and all the other Miami Vice stuff that you incorporated into it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not been cheap, but, I mean, obviously, I'm an interior designer, so, you know, it's kind of, you know, that's kind of what I spend my money on. You know, some people spend money on clothes or holidays. I spend my money on interiors. I reckon it's probably cost about £3,000, and that's
right,
including like bespoke furniture, customising the bag, you know, getting like murals painted and all that kind of stuff. So I've probably spent about £3,000. The average that people spend when Clink have done this research is about £227, up to about £500. But again, it's kind of, you know, how often are you going to use it? And, you know, like the research suggests that, you know, if you do put one of these home bars in, it can actually increase the value of your house. You know, people are looking around thinking, oh, I can imagine myself just, you know, sat there having a,
yeah,
having a cocktail or a few drinks.
But so, also, you know, Siobhan, if they were looking around the house and you thought the couple might be interested and you were trying to sell the house, you could make them a few cocktails, get them a bit squiffy, and they might sign on the dotted line.
Again, sign on the dotted line there and then.
Yeah, not a bad idea. What's your favourite cocktail, Siobhan?
Oh, I'm so old school. I'm so cheesy. I love a pina colada. That's
thing. What's very nice. And if your husband was to give up his real ale and have a cocktail, what would his tipple be?
He doesn't mind a gin-based cocktail, but nothing too sweet.
Right.
So whereas I'm just like, yeah, I like it pink. I like it, you know, the sweeter the better for me. Really boozy, really sweet. But yeah, he'd have something gin-based and a little bit less sweet than my palate.
Okay.
I think that's what he would probably go for.
And do you have, if you're at home all week, do you have some nights when you decide, well, not go to the bar tonight, or do you sneak up there and have a cocktail every night?
No, we definitely don't go up there every night. Probably like, you know, once or twice a week.
Yeah.
And again, you know, like on a weekend, if we've got friends coming round, then literally that is just their mission. Let's get straight up to the bar, get the music on. Get the lights dimmed, get some, you know, get the nice fairy lights going,
yeah,
in the neon, and Yeah, and it's really nice. And obviously the good thing about having your own bar is there's no single measures. You don't have to queue up for a drink.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can have whatever music on you want. So yeah, it's kind of, you know, best of both worlds, really, isn't it?
It is, really. Do you play sort of 1970s music?
Well, I would love to. I'm a bit of an R&B kind of girl.
Right.
But my husband is really into heavy metal.
Oh, dear.
So there's always a bit of a debate. There's always a bit of a music debate. There'll always be a little bit of a battle going on. I'll be like, right, you play one of yours, I'll play one of mine.
Mm.
And sometimes we can agree on a few things. But yeah, that's always the topic of conversation. Right.
Well, it sounds terrific. So that sounds, and it's the and it's the Tower Cocktail Bar. That's what you've called it, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, yeah. You've got to have a name for your bar, don't you?
Well, if we're in the locality, Siobhan, you know what we're going to do? We're going to call you up and say, come on, we want to make one of your best special cocktails. Is that a deal?
Yeah. You might be stumbling back after a few of those.
Fine, but that's fine by me. That's Siobhan Murphy, who's made this fantastic bar in her home. And she was the runner-up in the 2021 Interior Design Masters with Alan Carr. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. This is the Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.